Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's the Skull Horton Show. I've left no agenda, but I'm here on Liberty Express for you. It should be a pretty good show lined up. I gotta admit, I didn't do a very good job of getting a bunch of guests on today. I tried. But, you know, since I'm chopped liver and everything, I don't expect people to really call me back, you know? I don't know. I used to always have at least 3 interviews per show, but maybe it's a Monday thing. Maybe it's the tryptophan. Maybe people are taking a 5-day weekend. Anyway, hope everybody had Thanksgiving. I'm here, and John Glazer is going to be here. Let me put a little at symbol in front of his name here so that Twitter knows. John will be here about an hour from now to talk about the islands, the Chinese and the Japanese, maybe going to get the U.S. into a war over some crappy islands that are hundreds of miles from the gas field that they're supposedly connected to in the first place. The whole thing is completely stupid. But anyway, you may lose your hometown over it. I guess we're going to find out. Hang on, I got to recommend a good antivirus program to my buddy here. Get Malwarebytes, I says. Malwarebytes. That stuff rules, man. It'll kill all them little viruses you got on there. Malwarebytes. I like it. All right, anyway. So, yeah, it's the show. I've been just beating myself over the head about my failure to get in on the Bitcoin bubble when the getting was good. And I don't know, maybe it's not really a bubble. Maybe its usefulness as an alternative currency, ultimately, over the long term, will justify a stable price somewhere around $1,000 per Bitcoin or something. I don't know. But I do know that I could have bought Bitcoins when they were only 2 cents each, and at that price, I could have afforded quite a few of them. Also know that I sold the 12 Bitcoins I had last spring at $50. 49. Because I had to pay the rent. So that would have been worth at least $12,000 right now, which would have been a year worth of rent. For nothing, for free, for being smart and waiting around for other people to drive a price up. And the thing of it is, I'm a libertarian. So I've known about Bitcoin since they were very first invented. I just didn't get all interested in them, and I didn't quit my job and start day trading them or anything like that, but boy, I should have, apparently, because they're up by a zillion percent. I saw one guy in my Facebook feed who, I don't even know who he was. Maybe he's somebody influential in some circles. I just hadn't heard of his name before. Apparently, we're Facebook friends. But as far as I could tell, he was kind of a member of the libertarian movement, but not that I really investigated or whatever. It didn't seem like he was a leader in any libertarian institutions I've ever heard of, or a writer or an activist of any particular note. I think he was a member of the movement rather than one of its, you know, names or something like that. And his Facebook status was, "See, didn't I tell you to buy Bitcoins?" And he said he got over 40 emails from friends saying, "Thank you for never stopping beating me over the head about why I ought to be in Bitcoins. Now I'm a millionaire." I mean, that's assuming they were all selling it right around $1,000, but yeah. 40 different emails from overnight Bitcoin millionaires. And I gotta tell you, I have no idea what a non-mania price for a Bitcoin is. I mean, this seems to me like a mania. Everybody's trying to get money for nothing, like I'm wishing I had done, by buying low and selling high, but that's what's driving the price up. This is how a bubble becomes a bubble. First of all, you need a Fed printing funny money. In this case, giving people a reason to look elsewhere for a place to put their money. But then everybody starts doing it at the same time. A lot of them probably, if they're smart, or I don't know if it's smart or not, but probably many of them are actually buying the Bitcoins on credit, right? They're not taking out a loan directly. They're buying them on their credit card or something. And that's what's driving the price up right now. Maybe it's going to come back down. I saw there was a correction about $300 and then right back up again the other day. Well, yesterday, right? Or maybe it was the day before that, Saturday. But regardless, it's not just a tulip bubble, right? Even if it is a bubble in a mania, it's not just tulips because tulips are worthless, right? I mean, tulips are good for maybe helping you flirt with a girl, but there are other ways to get that done. And it's hardly the most saleable commodity of flower, a delicate flower, literally, you know, come on. But a Bitcoin has its use. It is not just a mania. I could certainly see, you know, assuming that the price will ever stabilize, which I don't understand all about, you know, whether it ever will or not or what or why, but assuming the price would stabilize and people could pretty much count on its day-to-day value, I could certainly see a use for a way to exchange money with each other where you don't have to go through the bank and wait 5 days as they make money, you know, interest off of your money that they're holding before they let you have it. Oh, Jesus, just our process. It takes a week for money to go from one computer to another because we're stealing from you, is the, I think that's the slogan for the Citigroup and Wells Fargo and the rest of them. We're ripping you off. But with Bitcoins, blam, I transfer money to you. I no longer have it. You have it now. Who needs a bank at all when all you got to do is keep a thumb drive? So I really like that, and I like the fact that it could be anonymous if you use it right, and I'm not the world's expert on that, but there is a way to more or less make your transactions anonymous through it, I think. Create new codes for new wallets and launder the money around or whatever, and that's fine because probably somewhere near half of all legitimate transactions are illegal now just because the government makes an offense out of everything that's not a crime. So screw them. I'm happy to see anybody getting around that kind of thing. The only black markets that I support being kept black would be markets of buying and selling humans. Other than that, from ivory to PCP to anything else, you got to legalize it. It's the only choice. But anyway, I hadn't heard anybody... heard of anyone buying slaves with Bitcoins, have you? No. So I'm all for that, the anonymity of it. And I can see the usefulness or the presumed usefulness of people having them to trade and not have to deal with government money anymore. Whatever. But mostly I'm just mad that I didn't buy them and sit on them back when they were 2 cents a piece. Geez, I mean, I probably could have even scraped up if I'd begged and prodded and pleaded. I could have saved up $1,000 and spent $1,000 on Bitcoins at 2 pennies per Bitcoin. And then, I think Anthony did the math. That'd be $50 million right now. $50 million. And I'm sorry to break this to you, but if I had $50 million, that'd be the last anti-war interview of mine you ever heard. Because I wouldn't be doing nothing but skateboarding until I end up, you know, with a body too broken to continue. That's all I would do all day. I'd wake up and get high and go skateboard, and that's it. For the rest of my life. If I had $50 million. I'd get a new board, too. The one I have, the wheelbase is like half an inch too long. It just doesn't quite feel right. I mean, I like a big vert board. I think I would even get new wheels. And a new used truck. If I had $50 million. Actually, I probably would still do this show. But I'd get a new microphone. I'd get a new mixing board. I'd hire an intern to do my homework. Can you imagine having 50 million bucks for not doing anything except being smart and buying bitcoins back when you should have? Man. I need to get John Jones on the phone and learn more about these damn Litecoins. Wasn't he supposed to send me a computer to mine Litecoins so I could tell you what a great Litecoin mining computer I got so you'll want to buy one too so I can make money that way too? Whatever happened to that? Hey, John Jones, send me a Litecoin mining machine, man. I want one of them. Doesn't everybody? I don't know whether Litecoins are going anywhere or not. It seems like, yeah, they are. I saw somebody say they went from 7 to 45 bucks. So what's that? That's a huge improvement. So, hell yeah. Sorry, I'm checking my email in the middle of the show. Sometimes I do that. Yeah, so anyway. Holy crap. Speaking of skateboarding. Oh, she's 7? I thought she looked younger than that. Well, he just showed a 7-year-old girl drop in on vert. But this ain't just, you know, a vert ramp like when we were kids. This is a 13-foot. This is a 14-foot or something. Danny Way-sized vert ramp. Well, this little girl's ripping. I'll tell you what, not that any of you care at all, because this isn't really a show about skateboarding typically, but man, when I was living in California, I went out to Venice Beach, and all the classic Venice Beach stuff from the skate videos when I was a kid and the Tony Hawk video game stuff, all that was gone by the time I got out there, and they had bulldozed it all and built a gigantic concrete skate park right there on the beach at Venice Beach. And I went there, and these little kids, girls and boys, see, I think the girl, she was like 9. But the boys were 5. And I mean, just turned 5. Not almost 6, but I mean, they were 4 like a week and a half ago. These kids were just little bitty boys. And they were so good, it was insane. They were skating the deep end of that pool, which the deep end of that pool was at least 10, probably 11 feet. And they're doing stand-up frontside grinds all the way around the deep end corner, like Hosoi style. And with style, you know? Doing frontside airs, at least knee-high, maybe hip-high. 5-year-old little boys. I couldn't believe it. Them kids at Venice Beach, they're just something else. And, you know, I've been skateboarding a long time, and I've seen... I mean, I didn't start till I was like 11 or something. But I've seen some little kids at like 6 who could skate. Who could do like a frontside grind. But 5-year-olds doing 4 real frontside 5-0s all the way around the deep end in a real concrete pool like that? Are you kidding me? Frontside airs, like real airs, leg grab out of the deep end? Crazy. That makes me want to go visit California. This little girl's doing blunts and stuff. She's good, man. Thanks for the link, Noah. That's cool, dude. I should post that on Facebook. I'm going to post the link on Facebook. You'll know why I got distracted off on that tangent. Tiny little kid. Skating vertical. Like a man. I got to appreciate that. All right. So, I got tons of news. I got John Glazer, so don't go away. It'll be a pretty good show. I'm going to go ahead and get to the news now because there's a lot of it. First of all, Mike Swanson, sponsor of this show and author of The War State. Has this great new book, this great new website about his great new book. And the website is titled thewarstate.com. Thewarstate.com. So at the top of the hour, when you hear the commercial for The War State, you could get it through your head that, you know, thewarstate.com is where you can find out all about it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to cut a new spot with the... with the goddang web address in it. Sorry, I got distracted by my email again. I'm gonna make a new spot for The War State. More accurately describing the book itself because now I've read it. And also, with reference to this new website, The War State. And the thing of it is, it's basically Michael Swanson's new blog, and he said he's going to be linking to episodes of this show. I see he's got one here in my recent interview with Gareth Porter. Very nice. And then also just War State news from around the place to help promote and support the book, which I think is very important. A real good revisionist history of the first few administrations after the Second World War, Truman, Ike, and Kennedy, and their relationship with the permanent military state, the national security state, and the military-industrial complex, too, but more the military side of it. All right. So, that's thewarstate.com. And, you know, by the way, I think you will see that... very nice. I think you will see... What was I going to say? Well, I'm doing too many things at once to host a radio show. God dang it. What was I going to say? I think you will see... Meh, I don't know. Doesn't matter. Go to the website. Get the book. Buy it. Read it. Wouldn't it be nice to read some libertarian revisionism of the Cold War years? I mean, there's always Murray Rothbard and everything, but this is new. And, you know, it's important to read what liberals say, leftists really, in their Cold War revisionism, because you can find out a lot of truth there. But, well, the libertarians are the ones who understand human nature and how the world works and how the economy works and every other thing that liberals are bad on. So, I really like it. I enjoy, you know, reading a libertarian take on all this stuff. I mean, even Chalmers Johnson, you know, went from right-winger to left-winger, kind of, you know what I mean? Or to, from conservative to liberal, anyway. So, as great as his analysis was, it was also terribly flawed at the same time by his liberal perspective. So, it's nice to have Mike Swanson here looking at this stuff for us. Again, that's The War State at thewarstate.com. All right, now, other news. My website, scotthorton.org, is getting fixed, and I mean fixed good. And I don't know how much it's costing exactly, a couple $100 or so, but I'm paying a computer genius that I know. And I know a few different computer geniuses, but this is a guy who, you know, when he's goofing off, he sits around reading how to write in WordPress code for fun. I know WordPress isn't a kind of code, but you people who know that know better than me what the hell I'm talking about. This guy knows what the hell he's doing, and what the hell he's doing is he's going to customize the front page of scotthorton.org so that there are different boxes that pull together the latest from all the different sections. Not all the different sections, but from the most important of the different sections of the website. So you'll be able to see the latest blog entry, the latest whole show archive, the latest interview archive, the latest objects in the store for sale, which will be mostly bumper stickers and books, I guess. So all that's coming soon to scotthorton.org. And also you can see we've added scotthorton.org/articles, where I have all the articles I've ever written. Stress is back up and going again. I've got scotthorton.org/Larissa. There's only one article there. But the plan is to eventually have all of her, the wife, Larissa Alexandrovna, if anybody's a fan of her. She's got 3,000 great breaking news articles I want to back up and have all on the site and anything. So go check it out. Check out the chat room, too. I'm going to sign in during commercial break. ScottHorton.org/chat. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze.
Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at myheroesthink.com.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here.
Why does that song come in so quiet all of a sudden? Or all the time, I mean. Didn't I normalize the volumes on all these? I tried to. Alright. I'm Scott. Welcome to the show. Alright, last thing I'm going to say about Bitcoins today. Give me some, please. You know, you can donate fractions of Bitcoins. Last night, someone sent me 0.02 of a Bitcoin. Which I guess would be 1/50 of a Bitcoin. So you can do that, and I'm extremely grateful. That's awesome. I had to sell my last whole Bitcoin for the rent for December. And of course, it'll eventually, one of them will be worth $1 million, right? Then I can hang myself from the ceiling fan, but... I do have now, I have 0.06 something 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 Bitcoins. So, I'm back on the path, man. And especially for all of you evangelical Bitcoin fundamentalists out there, don't you want to help me to help spread the gospel of the Bitcoin that you love so much? The more Bitcoins you send me, the more I will love you and them, and the more I will talk about them. Doesn't that sound like a really good deal? Oh, no, all you have to do is give me some. Gimme, 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 gimme. Wait till they crash and then gimme, 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 gimme. Further way back up again. How about that? All right. So I'm Scott. Hey, Case is in the chat room. Hey, chat room guys. We got Sneaker. We got Lugosi. We got Casey. Man, it's like the old days. Fitzy G's in there. Brooklyn. I don't know who Brooklyn is, but hey, Brooklyn. Hey, tell Jeremy Sapienza I said hi. All right. Coming up on the show, John Glazer to say important things about wars and policies and things. So don't go nowhere. Hang around here with me. It's going to be all right. Now, I'm going to start talking about important stuff right now. You may have heard during that commercial break that clip for the Council for the National Interest, where Phil Giraldi is executive director, and they do they focus on an America First foreign policy, and they're anti-imperialists. Of course, so much of our imperialism is wrapped up in the interests of foreign states and those in America who favor foreign states. So they're not exactly total peacenik libertarians, but they're very conservative. And in a real sense, not they're so conservative they hate everything and want to burn it all down. But no, I mean, they're so conservative that they would never do such a thing because that would cost money. And because that would be imprudent. And because empire weakens America. Even though it might strengthen Lockheed and strengthen Citigroup, it's all at the expense of the rest of us. So when the Council for the National Interest says America first, they mean the people and the land, not the state and its corrupted interests. First and foremost among them, the government of Israel. And so good on them. Thank goodness that there's one think tank in D.C. who makes it their priority to contradict the Israel lobby, while the rest of them try so hard to be polite. Why they should, I have no idea. Oh, money. But other than money, what's to support? Oh, it's the only democracy in the Middle East, except, no, it's not. Half their population is under permanent martial law, with no right to vote, with no representation whatsoever. and they've been occupied longer than the Soviets occupied Eastern Europe. You're telling me that's a democracy? And even the Israeli Arabs are treated like second-class citizens or third-class, like blacks during Jim Crow in the South, which America, for all of our flaws, at least we repealed Jim Crow back three generations ago. But that's how, and that's for the actual Arab, Christian, and Muslim citizens of Israel. The children of the Gaza Strip are simply prisoners. They're born convicts in a concentration camp, guilty of being Palestinian on land that Israeli Jews want to steal. Simple as that. It's in the WikiLeaks, which doesn't mean Julian Assange made up something. That means these are the government documents that the heroic Chelsea Manning liberated for us. And there are the Israelis bragging about how, yeah, our policy is to keep the children, again, the majority of the residents of the Gaza Strip, of the prisoners in the Gaza Strip, are what we call minors. Under 18. And the Israeli stated policy is to keep them hungry, but not starving to death. And you're telling me that's a democracy? That's not a democracy. That's a fascist dictatorship. For everybody except the people who run it. But, of course, it's the victims that define these things. It's like Noam Chomsky said about the Soviet Union. He said, we don't judge the Soviet Union by how the people in the suburbs of Moscow lived during its heyday. We judge the Soviet Union based on how the dying in Hungary lived as the Soviets killed them for daring to attempt independence. That's how we judge the Soviet Union, the way they treated their victims. You know, like the million Afghans they killed in the 1980s. That's what the Soviet Union was, a collection of butchers. That's how we judge the United States of America, too. How does a Falujan live when he's dying in a gutter because America destroyed his entire society? That's what America is. That's how you can tell what America is. What it does to the weakest in the world. Same thing with the Israelis. So, yeah, it might be a nice life in the suburbs of Tel Aviv. But for the Palestinians, Israeli democracy just means a bulldozer destroying their house that their great-great-great-grandfather built. Cutting down all their olive trees that their great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother tended to. And ever since in their family. Israeli democracy to a Palestinian means they're coming to bulldoze your cemetery so they can build a museum of tolerance on it. Yeah, you think I'm making that up. Google it. And then, oh man, I spent that whole time just on how they're not a democracy. How about how they're not our ally? Tell you what, I'll give you 3 minutes during the break. I'm in the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. Somebody chime in with one thing that the Israelis have ever done for America. And when we come back, I'm going to talk for half an hour about what they've done to us. The treacherous, traitorous Israelis.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact, there's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money.
My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, well, maybe that wasn't long enough of a break. If anybody wants, go to scotthorton.org/chat. I didn't get the phone thing set up or nothing, but... the question of the day is, can anyone think of anything that Israel has ever done for America? And I don't mean that any Israeli has ever done for any American. I mean that the Israeli government has ever done. Hell, they knew and did not warn about the Beirut barracks attack in 1983. That's what kind of friends they are to the Americans. Oh, the Americans are big boys. They can take care of themselves. They better tell us everything they know, but when it comes to helping them, screw them. I read that in By Way of Deception by Victor Ostrovsky, And his attitude was, he portrayed the Israeli Mossad's attitude as, oh, we don't help the Americans. If a bunch of them are about to die in a truck bombing, well, good. Maybe we can help spin this as try to get them on our side against Hezbollah a little more. Even though that was the Amal militia, who cares, right? Same difference, right? So in the chat room so far, we've got... Power Rangers. But that was just... that was an Israeli bagman. Not Israel proper, points out Fitzy G. That's right, Haim Saban, the funder of the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. Keeping Brookings fascist. I can't think of anything they've ever done for us. They're our greatest ally in the Middle East, but in what way that anyone can name? Facebook, too. You can tweet me. You can Facebook me, /Scott Horton Show. What's one thing that Israel has ever done for America, ever? Other than provide a target for fantasies of post-millennialist, dispensationalist, Darbyite wackos who believe that they can force Jesus to come back when they say so. Which is stupid, and of course, which is not true, and of course will never happen, and certainly not because they say so, and... That doesn't really count as doing anything for us, does it? Shoveling a bunch of crap down the throats of a bunch of stupid idiots who believe it so that they will then encourage the Republican Party to support whatever horrible policies atheist, right-wing nationalist Israelis can come up with for them? Give me a break. So that's it. But then when it comes to... hurting America, well, they'll fight to the last dead American. And they don't even care. I mean, look at Ariel Sharon in front of everybody. Lied us into war with Iraq. Had his agents in America, including Richard Pearl and David Wurmser and Douglas Feith and Paul Wolfowitz, lie us into war because they believed the lies of the Iranian spy Ahmed Chalabi, who at least the CIA and the DIA think that the Iranians helped him to lie us into war in the first place. Because they weren't stupid idiots like the neocons. They knew what was going to happen. They were going to inherit the south of Iraq. You know, I knew that too. You know how I knew? I just read a Tom Clancy book where somebody assassinates Saddam on page one. And the Shiites take, the Iranians take over the Shiite south with a snap of their fingers. And appoint the new government, and then that's part of the question is, how are they going to deal with the Sunni Arab parts of Iraq that are now losing power and whatever? That's part of the background of the whole story. And I read that in, like, the year 2000 or something. Too bad Paul Wolfowitz doesn't fly commercial. He might have read that piece of crap book and thought twice. But anyway, the Israelis lied you into war. You can read Robert Dreyfus in The Nation. His article is called Agents of Influence. And there's another one in The Guardian by the great Julian Borger called The Spies Who Pushed for War. And both of those describe how the Israeli, how Ariel Sharon actually created an Office of Special Plans in the Prime Minister's office in Israel just to manufacture bogus intelligence about Iraq in English for your use
to be funneled straight to the Pentagon, to the vice president's office, and to your local cable TV news channel. And that's how America went to war in Iraq. It's not that Bush and Cheney didn't want to do it. It's just that there's no way they could have done it when they took the entire establishment by surprise. What? You really want to do this? But they had the entire Israel First, Fifth Column, neoconservative movement, and the entire American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee on board with them. And with that, they were able to overcome the objections of the old establishment. See Sidney Blumenthal and all of his great work at Salon.com about the split, where James Baker, the oil man, who you might think, and I don't know, maybe this isn't true, but seems right to me, that Baker complained, I told him not to do that with the invasion of Iraq. Brent Scowcroft, George Bush Sr.'s alter ego, famously wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal called Don't Attack Saddam, which led to a big hissy fit by George Bush about, I don't want to hear another word from Brent Scowcroft, a.k.a. my father, about what I should be doing here. And that's because the Israelis at his National Security Council meeting, well, dual citizens, were telling him, oh yeah, war in Iraq is doable. War in Iraq will be easy. We'll create whatever new government we want, and they'll all lay down on their bellies and do exactly as they're told. Oh yeah, war with Iraq will weaken Iran. War with Iraq will make everybody rich. War with Iraq will be great. And he bought it because he's an idiot, and it's what he wanted to hear, but also he's stupid. But that war would have never happened if it hadn't been for the neoconservatives. And, you know, of course, you know, the liberal hawks like Michael O'Hanlon and Noah Pollock and all those guys, or was it Noah Pollock? I confused. There's two different Pollock guys. I forgot. That's their last name. I don't know if they're Polish or not. I'm saying, I think Noah is a right winger. There's a different one who I always pair in my brain with O'Hanlon, Michael O'Hanlon, and somebody, Pollock, as his sidekick, like Batman and Robin, the two Democrat warmongers, you know, the worst Democrat warmongers in the think tanks. Oh, hi, I'm very sensible and reasonable and soft-spoken, and I'm from the liberal Brookings Institution, and yes, we must all support George Bush and his aggressive invasion of Iraq, because or else Saddam will kill us. They wrote the book The Threatening Storm and all that. But still, they were just piling on. And in fact, that may have been right when O'Hanlon was making the deal with Haim Sabin for all that money for the Brookings Institution. I'm not really sure. But anyway, the Iraq War would have never happened if it's not what Ariel Sharon wanted. Simple as that. And then just look at this year. Well, no, go back a few years. In the worst part of the insurgency and the fighting in Iraq and the civil war in Iraq, and Benjamin Netanyahu just laughed, gloating that we are benefiting greatly from the attack on the Twin Towers and the American struggle in Iraq. Well, he had already bragged about how the attack on the Twin Towers was good for Israel because it meant that he could just hop on a plane, get on your TV, and tell you, see, all of my enemies are your enemies, and since you don't know the first thing about this yet, you're going to hear it all from me. Your enemies are my enemies. So, of course, great for Israel. Great. What a wonderful opportunity. Never let it go to waste, like Condoleezza Rice and Rahm Emanuel agree. But then in the worst years of the war, when Americans were getting killed by the hundreds and thousands in Iraq, Benjamin Netanyahu just could not contain his glee. He could not just keep it to himself. He had to blurt out in public about how Israel is benefiting from the American struggle in Iraq. Right? Not just from the Iraqi struggle in Iraq. But no, the more Americans die over there, the harder American opinion becomes against Muslims killing their sons and neighbors' sons over there. And that's good for Israel. That's good for pretending that their enemies are our enemies. But now come to this year, and whose enemies are whose? Michael Oren, the former ambassador, just left a couple months ago, the Israeli ambassador to the United States. Why, he says that we want regime change in Syria. And yes, we support Al-Qaeda in Syria. but we're supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria against Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is backed by Iran, and that's what's important to us. Well, that's why Barack Obama has been supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria as well. As he explained to Jeffrey Goldberg back in 2011, Jeffrey Goldberg said, hey, if we support Al-Qaeda in Syria, well, then that'll help weaken Iran, right? And Barack Obama said, yeah, that's why we're doing it. And then he got all coy and cheeky and cute for Jeffrey Goldberg, Netanyahu's man in The Atlantic. And he said, well, you know, Jeffrey, I can't tell you everything that we're doing right now because it's top secret. But why don't you go ahead and print that I implied that, yeah, we're backing the rebels, all right. The rebels being the al-Nusra Front, prisoner beheader, suicide bomber, bin Ladenites who have openly declared their loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri. And neither of them even pretended for a moment that this had anything to do with helping the poor downtrodden civilians of Syria. Give me a break. It's all about weakening Iran. So, Al-Qaeda, the American people's only real enemies on the face of the planet, versus Hezbollah, who have never attacked America, not even in 83. Again, that was the Amal militia. So, which side does America take? America takes Israel and Al-Qaeda's side against Hezbollah. Why? Because that's what Israel wants. Because Hezbollah is their concern. No daylight. There can be no daylight. There is no daylight. I repeat, no daylight, no daylight, no daylight, no daylight between Israel's interests and our interests. Oh, except for they prefer Al-Qaeda to Hezbollah, and they prefer that America back Al-Qaeda as long as it hurts Hezbollah and Iran. That seems to me like, again, assuming the false premise that any of America's foreign policy has anything to do with protecting the American people from those who are trying to kill them, it would seem to me like daylight. It would seem to me like their interests are the exact opposite of our interests, our being the American people, everyone who lives between Bangor, Maine, and San Diego, or, you know, Vancouver, Washington, or Miami, Florida. Us, those between Canada and Mexico, and Alaska and Hawaii, too. And when 2 months ago, when there was a question of whether we were going to attack Syria or not, who was the only pressure group in all of America that wanted America to go to war with Syria? Out of 300 million Americans, you couldn't find a single American who wanted to do it. Only the Israelis and their fifth column inside the United States, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. And if you went to Google and you Google searched for Syria and expert, you could only find the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which is a spinoff of the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, which is, again, simply Israel's fifth column in America. So there are the writers for the Weekly Standard and the Washington Post editorial pages, the National Review and the Weekly Standard magazines, and Netanyahu. And Netanyahu is perfectly happy for all Americans to understand that he would be perfectly happy to see each and every single one of us die to fight Israel's enemies for him. Whether outright conscripted to march across every Arab state, killing every man, woman, and children, or whether we all die in terrorist attacks on our local nuclear power plants or whatever the hell it is. Benjamin Netanyahu is perfectly comfortable. He thinks it's a good idea that the American people know that he is doing everything he can to ruin our lives, to get us in trouble, to create enemies for us, to create explosions for us to die in, so that he can have what he wants. That's not even a secret. You probably heard me kind of trying to be tongue-in-cheek about it back then, 2 months ago, saying, hey, someone should tell the Likudniks that they're looking really bad right now when 90% of the American people are saying, Syria? Hell no. And the Israelis are the only ones in America saying yes. And no, in case you're new around here, by Israelis, I don't mean Jews. Because, in fact, most Jews are liberal Democrats and super majorities of liberal Democrats. I didn't see the exact breakdown. I don't know if they did the Syria question based on religious or ethnic identity or not. But I sincerely doubt that a majority of American Jews supported the war. And that's certainly not what I mean. I mean the Israeli government, their fifth column, that is all of the pretended domestic lobbies and think tanks that actually are simply agents of a foreign power, and the neoconservatives, many of whom are Americans but would just as soon see every last American baby burn as long as it helps weaken Iran a little bit. They're traitors. And I'm a Lysander Spooner kind of guy. I don't really believe in treason, because how could I be guilty of treason if I don't owe you any allegiance in the first place? But these guys, they all do owe allegiance. First of all, every Israeli owes allegiance because we pay their way through their socialist education and healthcare system. And we pay for all of their defense. So if anybody ought to be on their bellies begging for approval, it ought to be them from us. And for that matter, most of these neocons have had government jobs of one kind or another. You know, even Bill Kristol used to be the foreign policy advisor for Dan Quayle. So that means he's taken a solemn oath and he's guilty of treason. He's guilty of treason. And it's the same for the rest of them. They're the only ones in America who want to stop a peace deal with Iran. You know, they did a poll the other day, last week, where not only do they have a supermajority of Americans want to see this nuclear deal go through, or at least pursued, not that they trust Iran, but they want to see it pursued. They also answered that if the deal fails, they want more talks and more diplomacy. If the talks fail, if the current compromise preliminary agreement falls apart, the American people want more talks, more agreements, no war. The only people who are against peace are the Israelis and their fifth column of traitors in this country. They're the only ones. Look at the polls. The Republicans want peace with Iran, too. The Republicans, it's their sons who die. I think liberals don't sign up their sons to die, mostly. And, you know, maybe it's just because they hate Barack Obama so much, they don't trust him to get into a war for them, but whatever. They want to see something worked out. And meanwhile, in case you think I'm being hyperbolic, well, here is Ehud Olmert, the last prime minister of Israel, from Haaretz, December the 1st, yesterday. Ehud Olmert, Netanyahu tried to interfere in U.S. elections is the title, but that's Barry in the lead. Former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert warned that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's aggressive quarrel with the Obama administration over the agreement with Iran signed in Geneva endangers Israel, and panned Netanyahu for, quote, losing his head. Olmert accused the Prime Minister of, quote, declaring war on the United States and of attempting to incite the U.S. Congress against President Barack Obama. Olmert spoke Sunday at a closed panel discussion on the, quote, strategic implications of the interim agreement between the P5 plus one and Iran, held at the Institute for National Security Studies at Tel Aviv University. Olmert said both his government and that of his predecessor, Ariel Sharon, wish to avoid public confrontation with the American administration over Iran. Quote, at no stage did we want to do battle with Israel's number one ally,
and to incite the Congress against the president, he said. Olmert called Netanyahu's acts and statements unprecedented. Quote, the danger and the potential damage from it are incomparably larger than the value of the public debate with the United States, he said. When Netanyahu took office in 2009, he changed Israeli policy in favor of, quote, declarations and threats, Olmert said. Olmert also said Netanyahu's Iran policy put an undue financial strain on Israel, criticizing the NIS, I don't know, that's military something, $10 billion, oh, I guess, is that their currency? $10 billion spent on preparations for a possible attack on Iran. This is money that was wasted. Yeah, that's kind of beside the point to me, other than, you know, it was our money and everything. Olmert rejected the claim that Netanyahu's threats led to the severe sanctions that brought about the compromise with Iran and said that these started before Netanyahu took office. He warned Netanyahu, without directly naming him, against a conflict with Obama. Quote, the man whose support for the state of Israel, his goodwill, is possibly the most important basis for the country's strategic interest. And added that, quote, we need to guard against anything that could possibly make it seem that we desire to fight with our greatest ally. Yeah, well, you might not just anger Obama. You might anger the rest of the super majority of the American people who want to see this Iran deal go through. I guess the real danger here is if they cross the president too bad, that might actually make the news. It might be too hard to ignore that there's the president looking out for America, even the empire's interests, and frankly, coincidentally, the American people's interests. And then there are the Israelis and their fifth column. There are the traitors who act under the marching orders of the prime minister of a foreign state. It's them versus everyone. Might that be dangerous? Later, Olmert said, it is possible to stand on every platform and tell the president of the United States, you do what we think, since if not, we will do all sorts of things. Is there one president who can accept these warnings that came from Jerusalem? Is this serious? And now, that's kind of a poor way of phrasing it, but he's saying, basically, he's just calling out Netanyahu for being crazy to hand these ultimatums to the president of the United States of America. Olmert also claimed that Netanyahu openly intervened against Obama in the U.S. presidential elections last year, a move he termed a historic mistake, which of course is true. He outright endorsed Netanyahu and urged anyone who puts Israel first to support, outright endorsed Romney and urged anyone who would listen to support Romney against Obama. And you know why? I think it's because Netanyahu is a white supremacist. He may be Jewish, but in Israel, that's fine. You can be a neo-Nazi, white supremacist, racist bigot against blacks and see no irony whatsoever, apparently. One of Netanyahu's ministers actually is quoted just last summer of when he's talking about expelling all of the Sudanese refugees. That what these people need to understand is that Israel is for the white man. And so really Netanyahu is just the Jewish KKK over there, right-wing nationalist racists. And he probably looks at Obama as though Obama ought to be bowing and scraping and shucking and jiving and cleaning his floor and lifting heavy stuff for him. Or else. Because Netanyahu is a horrible racist bigot. Put yourself in his shoes. Put yourself in Obama's shoes when Obama's got to deal with this guy, and he knows that from the very first time he meets him, all Netanyahu thinks of him is that he's, you know, the N-word that white people can't say. If I was Barack Obama, I would be making life so miserable for Netanyahu just for fun. Israel is for the white man. Anyway, what's funny is a neo-Nazi on Twitter got all mad at me for quoting that.
Like, hey, man, I'm sorry. It's not my fault. The Lakunics are just like you, Nazi. I'm just standing here, individualist, libertarian, free market me, watching in awe. And then I thought this was funny, too. Olmert attacked Netanyahu's wooing of Russia and asked rhetorically, oh, yeah, will Putin give us $3 billion a year in military aid? Huh? You really think that's a good idea? You're going to trade America for Russian support, huh? And how much support are the Russians really going to give you? So, I know I sound like such a cranky extremist when it comes to Israel, but I'm doing nothing but quoting Ehud Olmert here, the last prime minister, saying, in essence, that Netanyahu is making the difference between Israel's interests and America's interests way too obvious. And that this might backfire as the American people begin to realize that Israel is simply a millstone around our neck. That our empire sucks twice as bad as it already would because of them and because of their fifth column in our capital city. How in the hell is Israel supposed to last when they can't be democratic and Jewish? And they're now at this point, which that's what they insist upon while they occupy millions and millions of Palestinians and counting. And while they're doing everything they can over a short-term temper tantrum to thwart the wishes of the people of their most powerful patron, the American Empire. It's amazing to me that the Israeli people continue to support the right-wing coalitions to run their government. I mean, and I know the Labor Party over there is a joke and whatever. Anybody on the left, they don't have libertarians. And anybody on the left are probably horrible commies, but at least there's some kind of acknowledgement of reality. The actual facts of the situation at all when it comes to their dealings with the Palestinians and things like the nuclear issue here. This is madness. This is suicide for the state of Israel. And it's amazing. And by the way, in the middle of all of this, why don't you go read about what they're doing to the Bedouins? This is one of the interviews I was trying to get. The Prawer Plan, where they are literally doing a Trail of Tears force march of 70,000 Palestinian Bedouins from their historic villages, from 35 historic villages. They're just outright rounding them up and marching them off the property. Oh, the Nakba never happened. No. Oh, no, it's a land without people. But the Nakba continues every day in Israel. To this day. Like Andrew Jackson was running things over there.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for Braswell Business Communication Services at FusePowder.com. Braswell Communications can provide a credentialed media presence for your company at industry conferences and trade shows, as well as support services and consultation for publishing, editorial and technical writing, business-to-business and marketing communications, research, and information campaigns. Braswell also does website development and complete web content maintenance to include voiceover audio and copywriting. Strengthen your business. FusePowder.com.
Hey, I'll Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our guest today is John Glazer from Antiwar.com, The Huffington Post, and The Washington Times. Ain't that good? Libertarian, left and right, all together. Working that realignment. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me back.
Very happy to have you here. And now listen, mostly I want to talk with you about the Asia pivot and what all's going on there. It seems extremely important.
even a little bit scary, and I don't try to scaremonger too much. But first of all, I got to just make sure that this goes down in the history of the show in interview format here, too, and not just my ranting and raving. Did you see what Ehud Olmert had to say about Benjamin Netanyahu's America policy over the weekend?
I saw some reference to it. I'm sorry to disappoint you. You definitely want to get this in, but I actually didn't focus on it too much.
Oh, rats. All right. Well, he made fun of him for picking fight with America and asking what madness is this and that kind of thing. So, oh, well. Anyway, Asia pivot. You know, I read a thing that made sense to me in my brain, and it said that, you know, what's happening here is the Navy and the Air Force have the Asia pivot, but the Army and the Marine Corps have the Africa pivot, and that's sort of their compromise. you guys get to do this if we get to do that kind of a thing, and that's why they're doing both pivots at once. But I guess, actually, though, first question, are they pivoting away from the Middle East at all, or they just like to say pivot when they mean invade something?
Yeah, no, it's not a pivot away from anything, and that's obviously true. Even if the Obama administration wanted somewhat to pivot away from the Middle East and towards Asia, maybe even if it's just sort of marginal in terms of the difference, they keep getting sucked into perennial problems like Iran and Syria and the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and it's sort of a quicksand type of thing when it comes to diplomacy and the media and all that stuff. Those are issues that everybody has more of a bearing on, and the issues in the Asia-Pacific are a little bit more foreign to Americans, I think. And so, it's much less of a pivot, especially in terms of resources. We're still putting tons of resources into the Middle East. It's just that we're putting more resources in addition into the Asia Pacific. And that involves really a military and economic shift in which we are sort of surging the military presence with the Navy and the Air Force, and even with ground troops with regard to new basing rights in the Philippines, which we're in the process of obtaining. We're obtaining new basing rights for drones in Japan. We're working on new bases in Australia, which will hold a couple thousand U.S. troops, Singapore and Indonesia and Guam and all of this. We're refurbishing old Air Force bases that would help. They're meant as a deterrence thing, but they're really about, it's called an air-sea war in which we might have a conflict with China, but they would see all these bases and know that we could eliminate them in a rapid fashion. And so we're basically threatening military force against China for the crime of becoming a greater power in its own region. Mm-hmm. You see, the American policy, especially since World War II, has been basically one of world domination. And any rival state, any competing country that says, no, we're going to actually gain some of our own power, and whenever anyone thinks about that, I'm all happy to criticize the Chinese state. It's a horrible state in a lot of ways. But my primary concern is my own government and what we've been doing. This has, as you said at the outset, this actually is kind of scary because it could, there's a lot of reason to believe that these disputes that are sort of internal to the Asia-Pacific region could inflame tensions and end up leading to some kind of conflict. If it's not between the United States and China, it could be between China and one of our client states or some other kind of mix. But it really is kind of dangerous.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's it reminds me of the book The War State by Michael Swanson, where he talks all about Ike Eisenhower saw all of international affairs as a card game. He was a master bridge player. And everything is all just a hand of cards and this and that. But the thing about playing cards that way is you can make a really bad bluff and a really bad bet. And it sounds like in this case, what they're basically trying to do is say that the odds are so far in favor of the house that you're not even going to think about trying it. The only problem is, I mean, that's a huge bluff, which means anybody tries it, now what are you going to do? right? We will not tolerate the rise of any near-peer competitor or even the possibility that an alliance of separate states could ever combine to amount to a near-peer competitor to us. We'll kill you long before you're even in a position to defend yourself if you even think about trying it. And then, so what do the Chinese do? They go, well, all right, we're making a military no-fly zone thingamajig over here around these islands that we want back. What are you going to do about that? And so the Americans, with their bluff call, they start flying nuclear bombers through the no-fly zone. What in the hell? This is just, yeah, I guess, bridge is a lot of fun to play for people who are into it. But dang, you think you could just give these Democrats an Xbox and get them to leave the rest of us alone.
Yeah, this is what realists call a security dilemma, in which two competing states start to beef up their military budgets and surge their military presence in the other's arena of influence, and then the response from the opposing state is to do exactly the same to try to deter the other people. And this rising sort of a competition of deterrence really leads to a dangerous confrontation. And that's what we might be seeing, and it's really not an exaggeration. I'm just like you, I'm weary of sort of fear-mongering. But, you know, it was reported in the Washington Post that some analyst told this reporter that conventional strikes aimed at China could spark a nuclear war. There's people at the Council on Foreign Relations, like Elizabeth C. Economy, which she says, my biggest fear is that a small mishap is going to blow up into something much bigger. Another person, Sheila A. Smith, also at the Council on Foreign Relations, says if there's a use of force between China and Japan, for example, this could be an all-out conflict between these two Asian giants. And, of course, we are allied with Japan. We have a security defense treaty with them, which says that we'll go to war on their behalf if it ever comes to that, and that'll automatically involve the United States. This would be a great power war, something we haven't seen since World War II, of course. Yeah. So it's, you know, it could be incredibly dangerous. And, you know, as we're getting involved in these disputes, like over the unpopulated islands of China calls Diaoyu and Japan calls Senkaku, you know, this is a dispute that just has nothing to do with us, and it shouldn't have anything to do with us. The competing claims to the islands go back to a long ways. China claims that they owned them back during the Qing Dynasty, and you know, the in 1895, if you fast forward a long way, Japan annexed the islands because Japan was an imperial state back then. Then after World War II, when Japan was defeated, you know, it sort of gave back a lot of the lands that it had annexed. And so, you know, it's been this competing thing for a long time. It was actually very dormant until, you know, scientists started to say, oh, these areas are probably very rich in oil, gas, and mineral deposits, as well as being valuable fisheries. And that means they're important in a geopolitical sense. So now that China has a rising economy and a bigger military, it's sort of saying, well, we're going to pull our weight just as much as every other state is. And it could get really, really tense. What would be less tense is if the United States stopped saying to Japan, hey, we'll protect you and your interests in the island. Or if the United States stopped saying to the Philippines, hey, we'll protect you and go to war for you and protect your interests in the islands. We're sort of inflating the tensions that otherwise would probably be a lot more dormant, given that China is a bigger power than these states and has a bigger military at the time.
So it's not just that the Philippines and Japan are talking tougher than they would because they know that we have their back. It's that we're telling them to go ahead and puff yourself up and talk as much smack as you want because we've got your back.
That's right. There was an interview with the Chinese foreign minister, I believe, which he told the Foreign Policy magazine that, we know that the United States is behind us, and so we're not very scared that China's going to do anything out of the ordinary. Of course, that's not what China's thinking, you know? But the whole thing is ridiculous. I mean, the alternative to all of this mess, all of these entangling alliances that might lead to war, simply for the United States to stay out of it. I mean, it wouldn't affect our national security. It really wouldn't affect our economy, even. The fact that China's a growing economy is a good thing for people like you and me. Free trade is very good. It's very helpful. It's very nice. It's very peaceful most of the time. It's only a zero-sum game when states get involved. They want to say, no, we want the biggest economy in the world, and you know, we want protectionism for our economy as opposed to yours and all this kind of stuff. They're the ones that fight it out. But free people can get along great with trading economies. And the whole thing is ridiculous. I mean, what if we just stayed back instead of saying what we're saying, which is China can't use any coercion or force to change the status quo. Well, yeah, that's rich coming from the United States, who very explicitly operates on the basis of force and coercion as a means to an end. I mean, we see that with Iran. After every statement, after every official statement that's ever said about Iran, even during diplomacy, what you hear is, we reserve the right to defend ourselves or use all options on the table. During the Syria debate, it was very clear that we were saying force is a viable option for us to clear this up and stop the war, or to at least, you know, address the alleged use of chemical weapons. So China just views us as a total hypocrite, which of course we are.
Yeah. Well, we being our government. And that's the other thing here, too, is that there's no such thing as Japan's national interest or America's national interest or China's national interest or the Philippines' national interest. Or if there is one, it certainly cannot be ascertained by the politicians who lead it. All they know is what's good for them. So if being a tough guy serves the Democrats right now, then that's what Obama's going to do. And if acting like a tough guy is what's good for Abe's politics there in Japan, then that's the course he's going to follow. And I'm trying to remember what it was I read, John, where they speculated that this was a very hasty decision, creating this, I called it a no-fly zone, it's not, but whatever it is, this little extra military air patrol zone that they've created there, that this looks like a very hasty decision and probably one that the Chinese didn't red team, that they didn't ask, okay, well, wait a minute, so what could be, what's the most likely response by the Japanese and the Americans to this, and then what might we do, whatever, and so, you know, in other words, in China, they're politicians too, and, you know, their leadership has apparently painted themselves into a little bit of a corner here, and this is what we're really dealing with, right, is a handful of jackasses in capital cities here, there, or the other place who could get cities full of us real people nuked to death.
Right, because of their stupid calculations. You know, everyone sort of assumes they put these politicians on these great pedestals, and they think that they have wonderful strategic vision, and that they'll just take care of us, and they'll follow our strategic interests and everything. But it's a load of crap. I mean, the Chinese are going to make mistakes in this security dilemma, in this competition, and the United States is going to. And what's even more likely, I think, is that one of these smaller states, like, say, the Philippines, which has been outright threatening China in the international waters or close to their naval ports, with their navy, you know, that could really, they're probably more willing to go ahead and do some damage because they feel like they have the big guy, the United States, behind them. So it's you know, it's not only the mistakes of the two big players, it's also the mistakes or the bullheadedness of our smaller allies. Right. You know, the other aspect,
and maybe even the captains of certain ships out there on the waters who can make their own decisions and bad ones.
Exactly. There's so many variables here that could go wrong and really lead us down to a very dangerous spot.
Well, you know,
and it's all because politicians want to play chess with the world.
Yeah, you know, I don't know how many people would agree with everything in there, but I think that this is an important part of Pat Buchanan's revisionism of the Second World War and how it started, is that when Neville Chamberlain was embarrassed by his failure at Munich and when Hitler went into Czechoslovakia anyway, that in his emotional fit, Chamberlain gave the war guarantee to Poland. And when he did so, the I think it was Lord Grey and some of the others, the defense ministers and the others in the British cabinet said, "You did what? Oh my God, somebody call the insane asylum for Neville Chamberlain." Not over his failure at Munich, but over his war guarantee to Poland, because where he was thinking
this will be the ultimate warning to Hitler that you better stop here and you better not go on to Poland. What he was really doing was he was outsourcing the decision about whether the British Empire was going to go to war with Germany or not to the Polish colonels, who were themselves a bunch of Nazis too. And then because they had the British promising to back them up, and maybe they wouldn't have negotiated with Hitler anyway, I don't know. But they certainly did not negotiate over Danzig. And the war guarantee, in fact, is what encouraged Hitler to make the deal with Stalin. Let's half Poland, and then that'll buy me a couple of years to fight the democracies in the West before I turn east and betray you, Stalin. So, you know, terrible things can happen because, and again, it wasn't that Neville Chamberlain wanted to have a war with Germany and saw Poland as a great way to get into it. He thought that if he gave the war guarantee that that would be enough to convince Hitler to stay out, but without gaming the possibility of, well, then, so what if he doesn't? And that's the kind of thing we're doing here. We're letting not just the Prime Minister of Japan, but any number of people outside of our own state, which is bad enough, decide on whether America ought to go to war. And a real one, as you said, against a major power that has H-bombs, and thanks to Bill Clinton, the means to deliver them.
That's right. You're right to reference World War II, because the world kind of looks a little bit more like World War II, especially compared to how it looked in the Cold War, where it was a bipolar sort of a system. Now it's a lot more multipolar. It's still unipolar because the United States spends about as much on its military as the rest of the world combined. But it seems like it's moving in the direction of a more multipolar world, and that can tend to be a little bit less stable. It could go that way, or it could go the way of a greater sort of bipolarity, and China could really rise, and it could just be the United States and China. And maybe we have a new Cold War on our hands. Maybe we get involved in, you know, a new Vietnam, and we invent new domino theories to justify, you know, extensive quagmires in foreign lands that really don't have anything to do with our security, just as a means of competition with another state that we don't want to get rich or a military prowess. I mean, it's extremely dangerous.
All right, you know, but here's the thing that you're not addressing, John. The Chi-Coms! Yeah. They're evil, and they're yellow, and they're red, and they're coming for us!
China has no desire to really get involved with the United States militarily. They're looking to sort of defend their own sphere of influence in the Asia Pacific. Really, the territories and the waters that are just around their seashore and their sort of naval presence. They want their strategic influence. It's very, you know, this is sort of overstated sometimes, but it is very analogous to the United States and the Monroe Doctrine in the early 1800s, in which we sort of said to Europe, listen, stop intervening in our sphere of influence. The Americas, Canada, you know, Latin America, and beyond, this is our sphere. Okay, we're a big enough power now. We don't want you butting your heads in here. And that's what China's saying now. And that's another area of total hypocrisy, that we had no desire to conquer Europe. The United States was never going to, you know, invade the shores of Spain and Britain and France in the entire century of the 1800s or the 1900s. I mean, we eventually came to dominance because of our associated victory in World War II. But, you know, this is not about conquering the world for China, just as it wasn't about conquering the world for a relatively weak state like the United States in the early 1800s. You know, the other part of this that people don't really understand is that these countries, like the Philippines especially, they don't want U.S. military troops there. In fact, after the Cold War, the Philippines kicked us out. They said, no, the legacy of U.S. military presence on our lands has been absolutely horrible, and we don't want that anymore. We want our independence. We want our sovereignty. And to sort of launch a new imperialism, which is all the more blatant, you know, with Iraq and the Middle East post 9/11, at least there was this neocon sort of fantasy about that was about ideas, you know, spreading democracy, and they had this whole propaganda behind it.
Yeah, and preempting a threat that wasn't real, but still there was an implied defensive something in there.
Right. But with China, they don't have anything like that. It's very much, it's like a harking back to the imperial wars between Britain and Russia, you know, and the Crimean War and the world wars in Central Asia and stuff like that. I mean, it's very cold-hearted sort of, I don't even have the time to propagandize about China being a rogue state or, you know, supporting terrorism or spreading the democracy for all the world and stuff like this. The U.S. officials aren't even bothering with this. They're just pretty explicitly saying this is about imperialism. We want to dominate the world. China's coming up on us. And it's our business to squash that threat. The real question is whether China's going to just obey and lie prostrate, you know, and sort of give us their behinds to go screw again, or they're going to say, no, we don't want to obey you, and then we could come to a head, unless people in Washington get better heads and start to see that we can't continue on this road of world domination for our own resources and our own lives and our own security. It's dangerous.
Right. Well, and especially, again, this will be the 10th time the word ridiculous was used in this interview, I think, but here, China's our number one trading partner. China's everything. If, never even mind if we had a nuclear missile shooting war, how about just if, you know, trade relations were frozen? It would be the complete and total destruction of their economy and ours, and for a while. I mean, the recovery would be, you know, would take years and years, never mind the hole that they've already dug for us with this economy the way it is.
That brings up a really important point, Scott, because not only is this a military surge in Asia Pacific, but it's also an economic war. So the United States realizes that China's a huge trading partner. They own a lot of our debt, so on and so forth. And so what we're doing now is we're engaging in extensive diplomatic talks that are mostly secret. WikiLeaks just had a leak about this like last month. The TPP, it's called, the TTP, it's Trans-Pacific Partnership. And we're talking with all these Asian states and saying, yeah, we're going to do a free trade deal. In reality, there's a lot of corporate welfare and economic protectionism involved. But there's something interesting about it. It's a Pacific Partnership, Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it doesn't include China. Includes all these Asian countries, all these Pacific countries, but not China, because the United States wants to engage in an economic warfare with China. They want to exclude China from the global system of trade. And this is the first effort to try and do that. And it's really kind of astonishing what this TTP deal is really about. And I encourage everyone to read. I wrote an upcoming piece for the Future of Freedom about it. And there's you can go on WikiLeaks and read there. Their release. They released a 95-page leaked document, a chapter of the deal, and nobody really knows about it except for a few people. But this guy apparently leaked it, and that's good for us to know. But you know, this is an economic war as well as a military war.
Mm. All right. Well, now, so for the last couple of minutes, talk to me about the economic war with China and what, if anything, you think it might have to do with the continued occupation of Afghanistan that they're at least trying to negotiate. I guess maybe the first question there is Karzai really standing up to them about this? Or this is all just for show, for temporary, like usual, and then they are staying? And then is that about China or is that about anything?
We talked about this before. You know, it, first of all, yes, Karzai does seem to be standing up to the United States a little bit. He's refusing to sign an already written security deal, which would govern the presence of U.S. troops beyond 2014, probably into 2024 and stuff like this. The U.S. war in Afghanistan is a failure. The insurgency is still alive and well. We haven't built a state the way they wanted to build a state. It's a corrupt and horrible state that can just collapse at any minute, probably without U.S. support. So the mission there has failed, and that's why the Obama administration, I think, is the main reason, wants to continue to occupy Afghanistan. An additional security reason is that they want to continue to do drones in Pakistan, and Afghanistan offers the only and perfect state to be able to do those kind of cross-border attacks. The economic argument, the sort of geostrategic argument for Afghanistan, I think is probably a little bit less important in the minds of Washington. I think that you know, there is something to be said about strategic competition with China in the Central Asian region. China has been doing oil deals and pipeline deals and trade pacts and all this kind of stuff with a lot of the Central Asian states. And, you know, Afghanistan is one of them that they're sort of working on as well, although it's hampered by the war. And certainly, I think China would try to take advantage of some economic opportunities if U.S. military presence were to be withdrawn. And that could be one argument in favor of keeping U.S. troops there, according to people making policy. But, you know, that again, I think, is inflated incredibly. I don't think that you can really argue that it's in U.S. interest to continue to keep U.S. troops in a country where they have been for a decade, where they continue to be killed, where they continue to prop up a corrupt and weak and feebled state, and where they continue to spawn new enemies in the United States, where they continue to, you know, invigorate an insurgency against us. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons to leave, and they far outweigh, even in the minds, I think, at least they should, the realist minds of, you know, national security makers, policymakers, they should really just get the heck out and pull our guys out of there, because it's not worth the security competition with China.
The gains couldn't possibly be worth the cost at this point. I think that's pretty much unanimous among everybody who's not in the military or a Democrat at this point. Anyway, thanks very much for your time, John. Appreciate it as always.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, that's John Glazer writing for Antiwar.com, The Washington Times, and The Huffington Post. Left, right, and libertarian there. We'll be right back.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate you tuning in. We're not on No Agenda no more, but we're still at scotthorton.org and at Liberty Express Radio. And I still got some news stories to cover for you. I want to mention real quick, because I think this is important for a few different reasons. The conflict going on over the A-10 Warthog. Do you know about this? Have you heard about this? Well, Kelly Vlahos has written a piece for the American Conservative about it, about the Warthog, it's called, the A-10. Now, this is a plane that I think people are probably familiar with. If you don't know it by name, It's got a gigantic cannon on the nose, and it's got really big engines on its wings, and I don't know how else to describe it. Pretty damn big wings, and things made out of steel and titanium. It's made for combat air support. CAS, they call it, I guess. Combat air support. And what this means is this plane can fly really slow and really low and can blow the hell out of anyone who is attacking American soldiers on the ground. They get pinned down somewhere. They need air support. You want to call in an airstrike, this or that. Well, the A-10s come in, and just with their machine gun, even without missiles, just with their machine gun, they can tear a tank apart. And I don't know if that's because of depleted uranium rounds, or apparently the rounds that they fire from their machine gun are a foot long. And anyway, I'm not a warmonger. I'm not happy about American soldiers occupying anybody's countries or any of that, but I'm just kind of trying to take the situation, all things being equal. The situation that we have is American wars with our guys on the ground invading and occupying other people's countries, fighting against civilian insurgents. And you'd say they're a combatant once they pick up a rifle, but they're insurgents. That's who they are, you know? They're civilians. They don't have uniforms. They don't have a tax base. They're volunteers of the people. And so there's no armor to target from far away. There's no buildings to target, you know, with your satellite-guided bomber bombs. If there's anything, it's our guys on one side of a ridge and some of the other guys on the other side of the ridge, and they need close combat air support. Well, now I'm getting to the point. The Air Force wants to get rid of the A-10. They don't want to use the A-10 anymore. In fact, it turns out that the Army had to fight like hell to get the A-10 developed in the first place, because the Air Force never wanted the A-10. And are you ready for the reason why not? And you can read this and all the direct sourcing and quotations and everything you need are in Kelly Vlahos' article at the American Conservative magazine. The reason the Air Force doesn't want anything to do with the A-10 is because, one, it's just too cheap and old and easy. And they want to develop the F-35, a super-duper expensive $50 million piece of crap that can't even fly in the rain, and drop bombs from 5 miles away, or, you know, shoot missiles from 5 miles away, because they want to fly fast fighter jets like in the movies and stuff. And an A-10, basically, an A-10 and its pilot, they're just the servants of the Army. And what kind of self-respecting Air Force pilot thinks that his job ought to have anything to do with protecting the lives of Army guys on the ground? Their job is flying around and doing neat stunts at high speed and shooting missiles at Soviet MiGs that do not exist. Maybe picking a fight with China. They've got some fighter planes. Maybe you can have a dog fight with them. Maybe we'll lose Los Angeles in the process, but still. And anyway, for the guys on the ground, apparently, I've never been an enlisted man, but I'm just saying, apparently, the guys on the ground love the A-10. The damn thing can fly so low and slow that they can wave at the pilot and point, "Hey, over there, kill that guy over there." And it works. Much lower rates of friendly fire casualties. And, it's countable. It's a useful weapon for the kind of wars that America is fighting. Again, I'm not supporting the occupation of Afghanistan. It should have ended 10 years ago. It should have never began. I'm just saying, 12 years ago. I'm just saying that this is the economics of politics, as Obi-Wan Kenobi would say. This is how the government works. The Air Force is run by men who, like Israelis, are perfectly happy to see U.S. Army men burned to death. They don't care about that. They care about what? Themselves. And an A-10,
I mean, the Army is banned from having their own A-10s. They've got an agreement with the Air Force that any plane that's worth the crap, only the Air Force can fly. All they get is helicopters. But anyway, they're going to have to sacrifice their air support so that the Air Force can have F-35s. The Cobras and Apaches, they get shot down. They're really fancy on the commercial, but on the commercial, they don't have anyone actually trying to kill them. If you look at the history of the Iraq War, they brought in Cobras, and then they pulled them out of the field the first day of the invasion. Because guys on the ground with RPGs could kill them, no problem. Meanwhile, the A-10 can take a hit bad and survive and land. That's what it's famous for. It's a really tough plane. You can shoot it with an RPG on the wing, and it'll still fly out of there. Blow one of its engines out, and it'll still fly out of there. The pilot's sitting in a titanium bathtub, so he's really hard to kill. And so, Army grunts on the ground, according to the Air Force, screw them. The actual wars that America's fighting right now have no basis in the decision about whether to keep the A-10s or not. And here is what's hilarious. I read an article in the Austin American Statesman all about this. Actually, it was a Los Angeles Times article reprinted in the Statesman. And get this. The whole theory of the article was that the only reason anyone wants an A-10 is because of the military-industrial complex and the arms manufacturers lobby and the corruption of the Congress. Otherwise, we'd all be moving to F-35s right now. Everybody knows that. F-35s, they're the way of the future. But due to corruption and the military-industrial complex and its perverse incentives, you have congressmen who are trying to save the A-10 at the expense of the F-35. And that was the entire gist of the article. No critical thought into it whatsoever. Really? So the manufacturers would rather turn out A-10s that costs, what, $1 million a piece or less than that, compared to F-35s that cost $50 million a piece. That are pieces of crap that you can't fly at night. An F-35, you can't fly it at night. An F-35, you can't fly it in the rain, much less a thunderstorm. The A-10 is good even in a storm. In all weather, you can fly an A-10. The F-35, the pilot can't see out the back at all, in case he is in a dogfight. The F-35 has a list of things, we've talked about this on the show plenty, it's got a list of things as long as my arm of what's wrong with it, of why it's a complete and total waste of money, why the F-35 project is nothing but Congress holding you down and raping you and stealing your wallet. That's all it is. And think about it like this. If you were an Army grunt on the ground and you were pinned down, would you rather have an A-10 that can swoop in low and slow and see with eyeballs who's who and which way to shoot? Or would you prefer to call in an airstrike from a satellite-guided bomb from a fighter jet 4 miles away? Fighter bomber, 4 miles away. Cross your fingers. And anyway, I'm going on way, way, way too long about this. We shouldn't have A-10s or F-18s or F-15s or F-35s or any of these things. We shouldn't have an Air Force or an Army or a Navy or a Pentagon at all. What the hell is this? Fascism or something? We don't need all this nationalism, all this militarism at all. But I'm just pointing out that, you know, all things being equal in a vacuum and all of that, this is how it works. The Air Force is run by men who care about them. And they don't care who in the Army gets killed because they're not around to help. They don't care. Guess what? They never cared. They didn't want the A-10 in the first place. And again, you know, I should have her article up in front of me here. I don't have the quote right in front of me. But they talk openly about, you know, the problem is the Air Force doesn't want to be the servant of the Army. They don't want to have to, when the Army calls, help us, they don't want to have to come help. As far as they're concerned, the Army is a foreign country. Screw them. Army grunts or pukes or whatever it is that they are, they're a different kind of military man than our kind. So, to them, it's like the worst disgrace in the world, having their mission be air support for the army. You know, as though they were actually serving their country and not their service, which is a nice name for bureaucracy of tax parasites when it's under the rubric of the Pentagon and pretended national defense. That's how much the Air Force cares about your army grunt son. They just assume that he gets shot to death. They don't care at all. They never cared at all. They might as well be the government of Israel. They're perfectly happy to see every last American army man die for their short-term selfish interests. Simple as that. What a surprise. And I guess I kind of like the A-10 because I had a toy G.I. Joe A-10 when I was a kid. I think I did. Or at least I remember playing with one. I guess it could have been a friend of mine's. They were blue. And yeah, it was, yeah. Anyway. Okay. More things I want to say. Here's the thing I want to say. This general gave this speech. I linked to it on my page at facebook.com/Scott Horton Show. You can find it. This general gave a speech saying, we're beginning already to forget the lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan. And then the entire rest of his speech is an absolute incoherent mess of stupidity. What lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan are being lost that he's so concerned about? Well, one of them is that, you know, in Iraq, we realized after years of fighting over there that actually our political goals and our military goals had never met each other before and had no idea what each other were. And so, it sort of kind of didn't really work too good. And I think that's really true. I mean, it's easy to come up with Rumsfeld's competent and ruining everything on purpose, but I think there's a lot of just, that ain't my responsibility, that's your responsibility. That ain't mine, that's yours. Between state and defense, and really there's nobody in charge. If you ask General Casey or General Abizade, what's your mission? Our mission is go out and shoot at bad guys. Find some Sunnis who will defend themselves from us and then kill them. That's our mission. That's all we know. And if you're asking me, who's the caucus system? What's happening with this political party or that one? Or which faction is in talks with this one to share power over that? I have no idea. I don't know any of that stuff. You'll have to ask Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice. That's their job, not mine. And that's how that war went on for years. And according to this general, well, this is one of the lessons that we learned from the Iraq War, is that the policy and the strategy ought to have anything to do with each other. And you know, I think we're already forgetting that important lesson. Oh my God. And then he actually says, and I don't know exactly what this is supposed to mean, other than this is how army men talk to each other. This is what they mean about military intelligence being an oxymoron. He actually says, we in the army need to start thinking about land the way the Navy thinks about water. Huh? What does that even mean? Other than, I came up with a sentence that I can put on a PowerPoint slide. And it sounds like maybe it could mean something to someone else who understands what it means. Maybe. We need to start thinking about land the way the Navy thinks about the water? You mean like you should sail around on it more? Or you should not fight. You should just go fishing. Pretend you're tough, but never actually get into a battle with anyone, because, of course, anybody could sink an American aircraft carrier in a moment's notice. All you got to do is drop a missile on top of it. It has no air defense from ballistic missiles whatsoever. That's why there are no nukes on American aircraft carriers, because they're a big bluff. They're just sitting ducks. And if America ever got into a war with anybody who had the ability to shoot a missile up and then down, then they're sunk. The whole Navy's a joke, so they just fish. They sit out in the middle of the ocean pretending to do work. And maybe that's what this general meant. We ought to be more like the Navy. We ought to sit all around pulling each other's pud and doing nothing. And getting paid, paid, paid. See the world. I don't even think he meant that. I have no idea what he meant by that. And I don't think he had any idea what he meant by that either. The lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan. After 12 years of the war on terror, one important lesson that I fear that we have learned but are already beginning to forget is that the policy and the strategy should have ever heard of each other before. Oh my God. Are you really that stupid? People in charge of the military? Really? I don't know. People make the comparison with the Roman Empire all the time, but the Romans had a republic for 500 years, and then they had an empire for 500 years, and then it was gone. Now, you could say this is a fast-forward Roman Empire, but I think it's more like a slow-motion Nazi one. And not that slow. From Weimar Republic to Nazi Empire to total bankruptcy and collapse and 60 years, not 12. But it can't go on much longer like this, can it? Really? I don't know. One thing that anti-imperialists have that they can bank on is that this new lady Yellen in charge of the Federal Reserve is going to bankrupt America as fast as she possibly can. She is actually even worse than Ben Bernanke on ideology, because whereas he was a Chicago school Republican monetarist supply sider inflationist, she's just a communist. She's just an outright, well, and by that I mean Democrat, but it's the same thing. And what she's going to do is she's going to inflate the money supply so bad that the empire falls apart. And now I guess, you know, the foreign wars will be the last thing to go after they're done devouring everything you've got. But still, you know, in the human history timescale of things, it's coming soon and it'll be over relatively quickly. This is the lady who's criticizing Bernanke because he just ain't printing money fast enough. He ain't lowered interest rates low enough. Aren't they zero? Or 1% or something? Anyway. And even the possibility of the slightest bit of scaling back from destroying the money supply, inflating it to the point of worthlessness, even the slightest bit of scaling back is immediately denounced in moral terms as the worst cruelty. Which, in a sense, it is. It would mean forcing the recession they've been inflating to prevent all this time, but that's what we need. Well, what we really need is for the Fed to cease to exist and let prices find their own level on the market. But anyway, that's probably the best thing that the peace movement has going for us at this point, is that the Federal Reserve System is right now creating $80 billion a month. Wait, is that right? Is that right? That can't be right. Is it really that much? That's what the neurons in my brain are saying. I'm trying to remember what was the last thing I read. Somebody in the chat room, help me out, man. I'm slacking. I'm blowing it. How much are they doing in this non-tapering inflationary thing? How many? Isn't it $80 billion worth of bonds they're buying every month? And they're not going to stop. I wish they just doubled down. Once the empire's gone, a lot of the national government's laws and rules and regulations and powers over the states and the people will be gone with it. And then maybe we can be a normal country in a normal time, you know? I don't know. Probably not. One other thing. You might see a couple other things. You might see a lot of coverage of Ukraine in the news, as they say that, oh yeah, the government of Ukraine won't go along with the wishes of the vast majority of the people. I saw a lady from Chatham House, that is the Royal Institute for International Affairs, on CNN International this morning, talking about how, oh, obviously the people of Ukraine want what they want, but the government won't give it to them. Well, wrong. It's such a stupid lie. Ukraine is half red, half blue, if you want to call it that. I don't know, liberal and conservative, but it's half Western and Catholic and half Eastern and Orthodox. It's half pro-European, it's half pro-Russian, and they're basically geographically divided. And Yushchenko, the guy who faked a KGB poisoning in order to seize power in a NED coup back in 2004 in the bogus Orange Revolution, in the last round of elections, he got 5% on the first round and was kicked the hell out of power. And then he was replaced by the guy that he supposedly beat the last time around, who came in, and then who was making more pro-Western, pro-European-type noises about wanting to sign this new deal with the EU, a new trade deal with the EU, which is just, of course, corrupt, crony, whatever the hell, nothing really free trade about it. But then he changed his mind, I'm sure due to Russian pressure and influence, and decided not to sign it. And then, so everybody on the, I guess, so-called political left in Kiev are out in the streets, and they're trying to do this replay of the Orange Revolution, as though there is no difference of opinion here, as though the pro-Western politician, the most pro-Western politician, didn't just get handed his ass. And people say that Timoshenko, the gas princess, who's now in jail after a faction fight with the other Orange Revolutionaries, that she's the rightful ruler, and if it was her, this wouldn't be happening. And yet, she actually split from Yushchenko and sided with Putin. And that was why he locked her ass in jail in the first place. Anyway... the thing is a complicated mess, but what it really comes down to is it's an attempt by the American Empire to extend its way all the way into the furthest Eastern Europe to surround Russia in the continuation of the Cold War that should have been over 24 years ago, and eventually a push to bring NATO, to bring Ukraine into NATO and make them a full NATO partner, which is madness. And NATO should have been abolished in 1989 when the Warsaw Pact started falling apart and they tore down the Berlin Wall. Simple as that. It's at least 91 when the Soviet Union ceased to exist. Christmas 91. There should be no NATO whatsoever. And at this point, they're even pushing to bring in Georgia. And as Justin Raimondo put it in his article at antiwar.com last night, or this morning's article, if Georgia is Europe at all, never mind the North Atlantic Treaty Organization here, but if Georgia is Europe, then so's Mongolia. The hell does this have to do with Europe anymore when we're talking about between the Black and the Caspian Sea in the Caucasus, you know, beneath the Caucasus Mountains there? How in the world do they have any place in the European Union or NATO ever, ever? Especially since they don't have settled borders. Since they're occupying, or trying to occupy Abkhazia and South Ossetia, who want independence. So, anyway, just don't believe the hype when they tell you, oh, look at all these people protesting in the street because they want what Barack Obama and the Empire wants. Really? Is that what they're doing there? Don't buy it. Don't ever buy it. Not for a minute. And then, real quick, go to my Facebook page, to Will Griggs' page, for more updates on this. This is just a couple of cop stories to help round out the news coverage today. I'm sorry, I had more AFPAC, I had Syria, and other things I wanted to get to. But I wanted to point out this judge in Pennsylvania, who you may have heard of, who is simply selling children to the local private prison for kickbacks. In fact, somebody who knows a lot about the case made a comment on my Facebook page today. The only reason he got in trouble is because at his plea bargain, he refused to utter the phrase quid pro quo. And so they revoked the plea bargain, and he's now been sentenced to 28 years in prison. But he's not going to serve 28 years in prison. He's a judge. He'll be out in no time flat before next Christmas, if not this one. And this is a guy who simply was taking any kid that was brought before his court and he was finding them guilty, wouldn't even let them plead not guilty, wouldn't even let them have a lawyer, wouldn't even let them talk to their dad, get some advice, do anything. He's just sentencing them to juvenile prison, kidnapping them, enslaving them and kidnapping them, and sending them off, many of them, of course, to be tortured and raped by their guards, as they like to call themselves, at the local slave camp, juvenile prison in Pennsylvania. And so, wouldn't it be nice if something, something, something happened to this judge the whole time he's in prison? I think so, too. What would you do to a judge who kidnapped your 10-year-old son and got him raped in a juvenile prison? I would commit a crime against that judge's family so I could be thrown in prison with that judge so I could take his life myself. Isn't that what you would do? Isn't that what you would do to anyone who tried to kidnap your tiny child? Anyway, 28 years? Yeah, right. More like he'll be out before New Year's. Give it 28 days. Oh, and now I gotta go. I'm over time. There were more. Firefighter handcuffed, threatened to be tased. Pedophile cop in Illinois